This is Audible.
Harper Wave and Harper Audio present The Plant Paradox, the hidden dangers in healthy foods that cause disease and weight gain, by Stephen R. Gundry, M.D. and Olivia Bell Buell. This is the author. A note before we begin. Don't forget to download the accompanying enhancement PDF from your audiobook provider or go direct to www.harpercollins.com/audio/plant paradox. It contains useful information, recipes, and more, and will be referred to throughout as the enhancement. To all my patients, everything contained in this book I either learned from you or discovered because of your willingness to join me in this journey. If people see me, it is because I stand on your very tall shoulders. Introduction. It's not your fault. Suppose I told you that everything you thought you knew about your diet, your health, and your weight is wrong. For decades, I believed those lies as well. I was eating a healthy diet. After all, I'm a heart surgeon. I rarely ate fast food. I consumed low-fat dairy and whole grains. Okay, I will admit to having a penchant for Diet Coke, but that was better than drinking the original sugar-filled brew, right? Nor was I a slouch in the fitness department. I ran 30 miles a week and worked out at the gym daily. Despite the fact that I was hauling around excess weight, had high blood pressure, migraine headaches, arthritis, high cholesterol, and insulin resistance, I continued to believe that I was doing everything right. Spoiler, I'm now 70 pounds lighter and no longer have any of these health issues. But a nagging voice inside my head kept asking the same question. If I'm doing everything right, why is this happening to me? Does this sound eerily familiar? If you're listening right now, you too probably know that something isn't right, but you don't know what. Maybe you simply can't take control of your raging appetite or cravings for certain foods. Low-carb, low-fat, paleo, low-glycemic, and other diets haven't helped and were unsustainable. Or, after initial success, the lost weight quickly crept back. Nor has running, speed walking, weight training, aerobics, CrossFit, yoga, core training, spinning, high-intensity interval training, or whichever exercise programs you've embarked upon banished those stubborn extra pounds. Excess weight, or being significantly underweight, is a serious problem. But perhaps your primary concern is food intolerances and cravings, digestive issues, headaches, brain fog, lack of energy, aching joints, morning stiffness, adult acne, or a host of other conditions you just can't shake. Possibly you suffer from one or more autoimmune diseases or a disorder such as type 1 or type 2 diabetes, metabolic syndrome, or a thyroid or other hormonal condition. Perhaps you have asthma or allergies. You may feel that somehow you're at fault for your poor health or your excess pounds, adding guilt to your heavy load. If it is any comfort, you are not alone. All that is about to change for you. Welcome to the plant paradox. First, repeat after me. I am not to blame. That's right. Your health problems are not your fault. I have the solution to what ails you. But please prepare to have all your assumptions about what you thought you knew about living a healthy life challenged. This information will dispel myths that are embedded in our culture and introduce concepts that may initially blow your mind. But here's the really good news. The secrets I'll share with you will reveal what is keeping you sick, tired, depleted of energy, overweight or underweight, fuzzy-headed, or in pain. And once you discover and remove the roadblocks standing in the way of vibrant health and a slim body, your life will change. You see, with all modesty, I've found there is a common cause for most health problems. It's based on ample research, including my own papers, published in peer-reviewed medical journals, but no one has put it all together before. While health experts have pointed to our laziness, our addiction to fast food, our consumption of beverages full of high fructose corn syrup, and the host of toxins in the environment as causes for our current ailments, among many others, sadly, they are wrong. Not that these things don't contribute to poor health. The real cause is so well hidden that you would have never noticed it. But I'm getting ahead of myself. Starting in the mid-1960s, we have seen a rampant rise in obesity, type 1 and type 2 diabetes, autoimmune diseases, asthma, allergies and sinus conditions, arthritis, cancer, heart disease, osteoporosis, Parkinson's disease, and dementia. Not coincidentally, in the same period, there have been many seemingly imperceptible changes in our diet and in the personal care products we use. I've discovered a significant part of the answer to the mystery of why our collective health has declined and our collective weight has risen so drastically in just a few decades, and it starts with plant proteins called lectins. You've probably never heard of lectins, but you are definitely familiar with gluten, which is just one lectin among thousands. Lectins are found in almost all plants, as well as some other foods. In fact, lectins are present in the vast majority of foods in the current American diet, including meat, poultry, and fish. Among their other functions, lectins level the playing field in the war between plants and animals. How so? Long before humans walked the earth, plants protected themselves and their offspring from hungry insects by producing toxins, including lectins, in the plant's seeds and other parts. It turns out the same plant toxins that can kill or immobilize an insect can also silently destroy your health and insidiously impact your weight. I titled this book The Plant Paradox because while many plant foods are good for you and form the bedrock of my eating plan, others that have been regarded as health foods are actually to blame for making you sick and overweight. That's right. Most plants actually want to make you ill. Another paradox, small portions of some plants are good for you, but large amounts are bad for you. We'll delve into more detail on all of this shortly. Have you ever been told, you're just not yourself today? As you'll learn, thanks to subtle changes in the foods we eat most often, the way food is prepared, the use of certain personal care products, and the drugs that you assume will improve your health, you really aren't yourself anymore. To borrow a term from the computer world, you've been hacked. The entire collection of cells, the inputs and outputs within you, and the way your cells communicate with one another have been altered. Not to worry. This alteration can be reversed, allowing your body to heal and achieve a healthy weight. To begin the restoration of our collective health, we need to take a step back, actually several steps, in order to move forward. We chose the first wrong fork in the road thousands of years ago and have continued to take additional wrong paths at almost every opportunity. Just to be clear, the so-called paleo diet is the furthest thing from what I am talking about. This program will provide the roadmap to get back on track, starting with eliminating our over-reliance on certain foods as our primary form of sustenance. What you have just heard might seem so unbelievable that you may be wondering about the experience I've had that could have led to such claims, or if I'm really a doctor. I assure you I am. As a bit of background, after graduating from Yale University with honors, I got my MD from the Medical College of Georgia and then entered the cardiothoracic surgery program at the University of Michigan. I later won a prestigious fellowship in research at the National Institutes of Health. I spent 16 years as a professor of surgery and pediatrics in cardiothoracic surgery and head of cardiothoracic surgery at Loma Linda University School of Medicine. where I saw tens of thousands of patients with a spectrum of health issues, including cardiovascular disease, cancer, autoimmune conditions, diabetes, and obesity. Then, in a move that stunned my colleagues, I left Loma Linda. Why would a successful practitioner of conventional medicine leave such an important position at a prestigious medical center? When I turned my own health around and went from obese to slim, something in me had shifted. I realized that I could reverse heart disease with diet instead of surgery. To this end, I established the International Heart and Lung Institute, and within it, the Center for Restorative Medicine, in Palm Springs and Santa Barbara, California. I published my first book, Dr. Gundry's Diet Evolution, Turn Off the Genes That Are Killing You and Your Waistline, which described the changes my heart, diabetic, obese, and other patients experienced on my diet plan, and which revolutionized my medical practice and changed the lives of hundreds of thousands of readers. It also helped propel me on the path that ultimately led to this program. In addition to being a physician, I'm a medical researcher and inventor of many of the devices used to protect the heart during heart surgery. With my former partner, Leonard Bailey, I performed more infant and pediatric heart transplants than anyone in the world. I hold multiple patents on medical devices and have written extensively on transplant immunology and xenotransplantation. That mouthful of a word refers to fooling the immune system of one species to accept the organ of another species. Thanks to my work with xenotransplantation, I happen to hold the record for the longest surviving pig-to-baboon heart transplant. So yes, I know how to fool the immune system. And I know when the immune system is being fooled. I also know how to fix it. Unlike so many authors and so-called health experts, this isn't my first rodeo. I wrote my senior thesis at Yale University about how food availability at different times of year prompted the evolution of great apes into modern humans. As a heart surgeon, cardiologist, and immunologist, my entire career has been about how the immune system makes decisions about what is its friend and what is its foe. The wealth of these experiences made me uniquely qualified to discover the solution to your health and weight problems introduced in this program. In my evolving role as a health sleuth, I came to find that many patients who used my diet to reverse coronary artery disease, hypertension, or diabetes, or a combination of two or three, related that their arthritis also quickly began to subside and their heartburn disappeared. My patients also noted improved mood and resolution of fairly chronic bowel issues. Excess pounds disappeared effortlessly, along with food cravings. As I studied the results of the elaborate lab tests I devised for each patient and experimented with the allowed foods, certain striking patterns emerged, which made me start tinkering with the original dietary program. Rewarding as these results were, it wasn't enough for me just to see these dramatic improvements in my patients. I needed to know the whats and whys. Remember, I'm a researcher as well as a physician. What altered that had made them ill and overweight? Which items on the lists of good and bad foods that I gave all my patients restored their health? Or, more important, which eliminated foods had been part of the problem? And were factors other than dietary changes also playing a role? Meticulous review of my patients' histories, physical conditions, specialized lab tests, and tests on the flexibility of blood vessels convince me that most of them, and most likely you as well, are literally at war with themselves, thanks to common disruptors that interfere with the body's natural ability to heal itself. These disruptors encompass changes in how food animals are themselves fed, as well as in some foods that are regarded as healthful, whole grains, lentils, and other beans, for example. Plus a host of chemicals, including herbicides like Roundup, and the use of broad-spectrum antibiotics. On top of that, I found that antacids, aspirin, and other non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs, NSAIDs, have drastically changed the environment in your gut. Over the past 15 years, I presented my findings at prestigious academic medical conferences, such as the American Heart Association, and published them in peer-reviewed medical journals, all the while refining my program. As a result of this work, I have become an acknowledged expert on the human microbiome, the bacterial and other organisms that live in you and on you. As it stands, the Plant Paradox program consists of a cornucopia of vegetables, limited amounts of high-quality protein sources, as well as certain fruits, but only in season, tree nuts, and certain dairy products and oils. Equally important are the foods I omit, at least initially, namely grains and the flours made from them, pseudograins, lentils, and other legumes, including all soy products, fruits that we call vegetables, tomatoes, peppers, and their kin, and refined oils. You may be in a rush to get started on the Plant Paradox program, ASAP, but I found that my patients are far more likely to succeed in healing themselves when they understand the root causes behind their poor health. So, before we get to the solution, I'll spend part one explaining the often shocking and frequently amazing story of those root causes and how they have affected most of us over the last several decades. When you get to part two, you'll learn how to start the program with a 3-day cleanse. Then you'll find out how to repair your damaged gut and feed your gut microbes the food they need to thrive, including a group of foods called resistant starches, which conveniently also help you feel satiated and shed unwanted pounds and inches. Once you've stabilized your health, you'll move on to phase 3 of the Plant Paradox program, which becomes your blueprint for longevity. The program includes regular, modified fasts to give your gut a mini vacation from the hard work of digestion. At the same time, it allows the energy-producing mitochondria in your brain and cells a chance to enjoy a well-deserved rest. For those of you with acute health needs, I provided a chapter on the Plant Paradox Intensive Care Program. In part 3, I'll provide meal plans and simple but delectable recipes for all 3 phases of the Plant Paradox Program. They'll make you forget those problematic foods that once kept you plump, sick, and in pain. While modifying your eating habits is a significant component of the program, I'll also recommend other changes, such as eliminating certain over-the-counter drugs and personal care products. Follow the complete program, and I promise you will banish most, if not all, of your health problems, achieve a healthy weight, reboot your energy level, and elevate your mood. Once you start experiencing the effects of this new approach to eating and living, my patients start to feel better and lose weight within days, you'll understand the remarkable changes that occur when you feed your body and your microbiome foods on which it thrives. As an added reward, you will simultaneously eliminate the disruptive ingredients and other agents that stand in the way of enjoying a long, healthy life. Keep listening so I can begin to share this life-changing experience with you. Part 1, The Dietary Dilemma. Chapter 1, The War Between Plants and Animals. Don't let the title of this chapter worry you. You haven't mistakenly dipped into a botany textbook or parachuted into the set of Avatar. You have my assurance that this program will help you learn how to be slim and energized and lay the foundation for vibrant health and longevity. If you wonder why knowing how plants operate could possibly affect you, to say nothing of whether plants possess intention, fasten your seatbelt and prepare to be amazed as we take a brief tour through the last 400 million years. Along the way, you'll come to understand that leaves, fruits, grains, and other vegetable foods aren't just sitting there accepting their fate as part of your dinner. They have their own sophisticated ways of defending themselves from plant predators like you, including the use of toxic chemicals. But first, let me make one thing crystal clear. There is no question that consuming certain plants is essential for good health, and therein lies the paradox. They power your body and provide most of the hundreds of vitamins, minerals, antioxidants, and other nutrients that you need not just to live, but also to thrive. Over the last 15 years, more than 10,000 of my patients have found that following my Plant Paradox program results in both weight loss and remarkable reversals of numerous health problems. Meanwhile, people whose digestive issues had made them unable to keep pounds on were finally able to achieve and maintain a healthy weight. Unlike the paleo diet or other low-carb or even ketogenic diets, all of which stress heavy meat consumption, you'll be dining mostly on certain plant foods, as well as a small amount of wild fish and shellfish and the occasional serving of pastured meat. I also provide vegan and vegetarian variations. Now, here's the shocker to start off your re-education. The more fruit I removed from an individual's diet, the healthier he or she became, and the more his or her cholesterol numbers and markers for kidney function improved. The more I removed vegetables that have lots of seeds, such as cucumbers and squash, the better my patients felt, the more weight they lost, and the more their cholesterol levels improved. By the way, any so-called vegetable that has seeds, such as a tomato, cucumber, or squash, or even string beans, is botanically a fruit. Plus, the more shellfish and egg yolks the patients ate, the lower their cholesterol numbers. Yes, that's correct. Eating shellfish and egg yolks dramatically reduces total cholesterol. As I said in the introduction, forget everything you thought you knew was true. It's all about survival. Every living thing possesses the drive to survive and pass on its genes to future generations. We consider plants our friends because they feed us, but plants regard all plant predators, including us, as enemies. However, even enemies have their uses. Therein lies the dilemma we plant eaters face. The very foods we need to eat have their own ways of discouraging us from consuming them and their offspring. The result is an ongoing battle between the animal kingdom and the plant kingdom. But not all plants are created equal. Some of the very vegetables and fruits that sustain us simultaneously contains substances that can harm us. We've been glossing over this paradox for literally 10,000 years. Gluten, of course, is one example of a plant component that is problematic for some people, as the recent gluten-free craze has spotlighted. But glutens are just one example of the kind of protein known as a lectin and one factor in the plant paradox, and they may well have sent us off on a wild goose chase, as you'll soon learn. I'll introduce you to the larger world of lectins later in this chapter. The Plant Paradox program offers a broader, more nuanced, and more comprehensive look at how plants can sometimes hurt us, and also reveals the link among lectins and other defensive plant chemicals, weight gain, and disease. Humans and other plant eaters are not the only ones with an agenda. Quite simply, plants don't want to be eaten. And who can blame them? Like any living thing, their instinct is to propagate the next generation of their species. To this end, plants have come up with devilishly clever ways to protect themselves and their offspring from predators. Again, let me make it crystal clear, I am not anti-plant. If you have ever had lunch with me, you'll know that I am a devoted plant predator. That said, I will guide you through the confusing garden of plant options to teach you which are your friends, which are your foes, and which can be tamed in one way or another, perhaps with certain preparation methods or by eating them only in season. In the deadly game of predator versus prey, an adult gazelle can often outrun a hungry lioness. An alert sparrow can take flight when stalked by a domestic cat. A skunk can let loose a spray of noxious liquid to temporarily blind a fox. The stakes aren't always rigged against the prey. But when the prey is a plant, the poor thing is helpless, right? No way. Plants appeared on land about 450 million years ago, long before the first insects arrived 90 million years later. Until those plant predators turned up, it must have truly been a Garden of Eden for plants. There was no need to run, hide, or fight. They could grow and thrive in peace, unfettered in their production of the seeds that would become the next generation of their species. But when insects and other animals, and eventually our primate ancestors, arrived, it was game on. These species saw those tasty greens and seeds as dinner. And although plants don't want to be eaten any more than you would, animals would seem to have the advantage, with wings and/or legs to propel them over to that grove of immobile greens to gobble them up. Not so fast. Plants have actually evolved an awesome array of defensive strategies to protect themselves, or at least their seeds, from animals of all shapes and sizes, including humans. Plants may use a variety of physical deterrents, such as color to blend into their surroundings, an unpleasant texture, sticky stuff such as resins and saps that entangle insects, provide protective cover by making sand or soil clump, or attract grit that makes them unpleasant to eat, or a simple reliance on a hard outer coating, such as a coconut, or spine-tipped leaves, such as an artichoke. Other defensive strategies are far subtler. Plants are great chemists, and alchemists for that matter. They can turn sunbeams into matter. They have evolved to use biological warfare to repel predators, poisoning, paralyzing, or disorienting them, or to reduce their own digestibility to stay alive and protect their seeds, enhancing the chances that their species will endure. Both these physical and chemical defensive strategies are remarkably effective at keeping predators at bay, and even sometimes at getting animals to do their bidding. Because their initial predators were insects, plants developed some lectins that would paralyze any unfortunate bug that tried to dine on them. Obviously, there is a quantum size difference between insects and mammals, but both are subject to the same effects. If you are suffering from neuropathy, take notice. Clearly, most of you won't be paralyzed by a plant compound within minutes of eating it, although a single peanut, a lectin, certainly has the potential to kill certain people. But we are not immune to the long-term effects of eating certain plant compounds. Because of the huge number of cells we mammals have, we may not see the damaging results of consuming such compounds for years. And even if this is happening to you, you don't know it yet. I learned this connection by hundreds of my patients who respond almost instantly, often in fascinating ways, to these mischievous plant compounds. For this reason, I call these patients my canaries. Coal miners used to take caged canaries into the mines with them because the birds are especially subject to the lethal effects of carbon monoxide and methane. As long as the canaries sang, the miners felt safe, but if the chirping stopped, it was a clear signal to evacuate the mine post-haste. My canaries are more sensitive to certain lectins than the average person, which is actually an advantage in terms of seeking help sooner rather than later. You'll learn about some of them in the success stories throughout the book. Note that all but a few names are pseudonyms to protect people's privacy. Success story. An unhappy canary sings again. Paul G. is 32 years old, a computer programmer, and formerly an active outdoorsman. He suffered from POTS syndrome, sudden low blood pressure, and was allergic to almost everything, breaking out regularly in severe hives. He couldn't leave his own house or go to his parents' house without experiencing a powerful reaction. Paul also had dangerously high cortisol and inflammation levels. Because he was allergic to most foods, he was emaciated. After 10 months of following the Plant Paradox program, Paul's POTS syndrome was gone and his cortisol level was normal, as were his markers for inflammation. He now takes no medications and is enjoying camping and other outdoor activities. He is gaining weight and can now visit his parents' home and other places without any allergic reactions. Plants are master manipulators. A little botany lesson here. Seeds are actually the plant's babies, which become the next generation of a plant species. No, I'm not being sentimental or anthropomorphic. Botanists and other scientists regularly refer to plant seeds as babies. It's a tough world out there for those potential plants, so a lot more are produced than will ever actually take root. Plant seeds can be divided into two basic types. Some are babies that plants actually want predators to eat. These seeds are encased in a hard coating designed to survive a trip all the way through the predator's GI tract. Although a large baby, such as a peach seed, might not be swallowed and instead simply be left behind. Then there are naked babies, which lack such a protective coating. The plant does not want these to be eaten. More on them shortly. Fruit trees, which bear seeds encased in a hull, are one example of the first type of plant seeds. The mother plant relies on animals to eat the seeds before they fall to the ground. The objective is to have their babies wind up some distance away from the mother plant, so they don't have to compete with it for sun, moisture, and nutrients. This increases the species' chances of survival, while also broadening its range. If the swallowed seed remains intact, it emerges from the animal along with a nice dollop of poop to boost its chance of sprouting. Thanks to the protective hull, there is no need for such plants to resort to a chemical defense strategy in the seeds. In fact, quite the opposite. The plant uses several devices to attract the predator's attention, thereby encouraging the predator to eat its offspring. One is color. For this reason, all animals that eat fruit have color vision. But the plant doesn't want its babies to be eaten before the protective coating is completely hardened. So it uses the color of unripe fruit, usually green, to convey the message "not yet" to the predator. Just in case the predator can't interpret this signal, the plant often increases the toxin levels in the unripe fruit itself to make it absolutely clear that the time is not ripe. Before such things as the Granny Smith apple were introduced to this country, youngsters of my generation who ate green apples learned the hard way via the green apple two-step, diarrhea, not to eat fruit before it was ripe. So, when is the right time for the predator to consume the fruit? Again, the plant uses the color of the fruit to signal to predators that it is ripe, which means that the seed's hull has hardened, and therefore the sugar content is at its height. Incredibly, the plant has chosen to manufacture fructose instead of glucose as the sugar in fruit. Glucose raises insulin levels in primates and humans, which initially raises levels of leptin, a hunger-blocking hormone. But fructose does not. As a result, the predator never receives the normal message that it is full, which would signal it to stop eating. Would it surprise you that great apes gain weight only during the time of year when fruit is ripe? That makes for a win-win for predator and prey. The animal obtains more calories, and because it keeps eating more and more fruit, and therefore more seeds, the plant has a better chance of distributing more of its babies. Of course, this is no longer a win-win for most modern humans, who don't need the additional calories in ripe fruit that were so essential for hunter-gatherers and our ape relatives. And even if we still needed those calories, until the last few decades, most fruit was available only once a year, in the summer. As will soon become clear, year-round availability is making you sick and overweight. Timing is everything, but looks can be deceiving. So, as we've learned, plants use color to communicate the message that their fruit is ready to harvest, meaning the mature seed hull is hard and has the best chance of making it through the predator's digestive tract unscathed. In this case, green means stop, and red and orange and yellow means go. Red, orange, and yellow signal sweetness and desirability to your brain, a concept that food marketers have long known about and employed. Next time you are in the snack food aisle in the supermarket, check out the packaging and signage, and you'll see that both forms of marketing are dominated by these warm colors. Plants have long taught us to associate red, yellow, and orange colors with ripeness. However, now when you buy fruit in North America in December, it was likely grown in Chile or another country in the southern hemisphere, picked slightly unripe, and then given a blast of ethylene oxide when it arrived at its destination. The ethylene oxide exposure changes the color to make the fruit appear ripe and ready to eat, but the lectin content remains high because the protective coating of the seed never fully matured, and the fruit never got the message from the parent plant to reduce the lectin content. Again, when fruit is allowed to ripen naturally, the parent plant reduces the amount of lectin surrounding the seeds in the fruit and skin, and then communicates this information by changing color. In contrast, gassing artificially changes the color of the fruit, but the lectin protection system remains in effect. Thanks to the high lectin count, eating fruit picked too early is detrimental to your health. That's one reason in part two I recommend that you eat only locally grown produce and only during key times during the year. In Europe, most out-of-season fruit is grown in Israel or North Africa. Because it does not have to travel a long distance over several days, it may be picked ripe and not have to be gassed. It's possible that eating naturally ripened fruit with lower lectin content help explain why Europeans are generally healthier and slimmer than those of us on the other side of the pond. Biological warfare. In the case of naked seeds, plants use a divergent strategy. These grasses, vines, and other plants that grow out in the open fields have already chosen a fertile spot in which to grow. They want their babies to fall in place and take root there. That way, after the parent plants die off in the winter, the babies will sprout the following season, replacing the earlier generation. There is no advantage to being carried off, so the plant must discourage insects or other animals from consuming its babies and transporting them elsewhere. Instead of a hard casing, the naked seed contains one or more chemicals that weaken predators, paralyze them, or make them ill, so they won't make the mistake of eating the plant again. These substances include phytates, often referred to as anti-nutrients, which prevent absorption of minerals in the diet, trypsin inhibitors, which keep digestive enzymes from doing their job, interfering with the predator's growth, and lectins, which are designed to disrupt cellular communication by, among other things, causing gaps in the intestinal wall barrier, a condition known as leaky gut. Whole grains actually contain all three of these defensive chemicals in the fibrous hull, husk, and bran. Teaser alert, this is just one reason that the idea of whole grain goodness is a huge misconception, as you'll learn in Chapter 2. Still other plant predator dissuaders include tannins, which impart a bitter taste, and the alkaloids found in the stems and leaves of the nightshade family. You may already know that nightshades, which include such culinary favorites as tomatoes, potatoes, eggplants, and peppers, are highly inflammatory. We'll come back to the nightshade family, which also includes goji berries, as well as to grains and to beans and other legumes later. Do plants think? Plotting to harm us? Concocting chemicals to deter predators? Convincing animals to transport their seeds to other locales to expand their territory? Such strategies suggest that plants are capable of intention, perhaps even of learning. Now you're thinking, come on, surely they can't do that. To be sure, plants don't think in the way you and I conceive of thinking. But any living thing wants to survive and reproduce. In terms of evolutionary strategy, whether you are a simple plant or a complex superorganism like a human being, any compound that can be produced, even if by accident, and ensures more copies of your genes will survive and be propagated gives you an advantage. If you're a plant, any compound that makes your predator think twice about eating your offspring is a good thing from your viewpoint. Think about that the next time you encounter a jalapeno pepper. Did you know that a plant knows when it's being eaten? Well, as recent research reveals, it does. But it doesn't just sit there and accept its fate. It deploys troops to defend itself in an effort to stop the predator. In this case, the research subject was a plant called Thalecress, Arabidopsis thaliana, a member of the cabbage family. Thalecress was the first plant to have its genome sequenced, so researchers have a better understanding of its inner workings than of most other plants. To find out if the plant was aware of being eaten, the scientists recreated the vibrations that a caterpillar makes as it eats the leaves. They also recorded other vibrations that the plant might experience, such as that of wind blowing. Sure enough, the cress responded to the vibrations that mimic a munching caterpillar by upping its production of mildly toxic mustard oils and delivering them to the leaves to deter predators. The plant showed no response to wind or other vibrations. Another example is the sensitive plant, Mimosa pudica, which is deserving of its name. It has learned to protect itself from being disturbed, which includes being eaten, by defensively folding its leaves in response to touch. In fact, the leaf folding behavior is more pronounced and persistent when it grows in an area where it has been particularly subject to interference than when it grows in an undisturbed area. Whoa! Thinking, reasoning, plants. This isn't their first rodeo either. Plants also respond to circadian rhythms, just as humans and other animals do. In one study, researchers found the so-called clock gene in plants determines the time of day a plant will produce an insecticide to coincide with the time a predator is likely to be on the prowl. When the researcher removed the clock gene from the plant, it lost its ability to produce the toxin. Finally, Let's focus on the plant chemical you probably had never heard of until you started listening to this program, lectins. Yes, you are hearing that word correctly. It is lectin, not lecithin, a fatty substance in a plant or animal, or leptin, the appetite-regulating hormone I've mentioned before. When bugs start eating leaves on one side of a plant, the lectin content doubles almost immediately on the other side, as the plant valiantly struggles to dissuade further consumption. As you'll come to learn, lectins play a key role in the defensive strategies that plants use to protect themselves, and they also play a key role in harming us. Edible enemies. So, what are lectins anyway? For the most part, with one important exception, they are large proteins found in plants and animals, and they are a crucial weapon in the arsenal of strategies that plants use to defend themselves in their ongoing battle with animals. Scientists discovered lectins in 1884 as part of their investigation into different blood types. Until now, you have probably been familiar with only one famous, or rather infamous, lectin, gluten. There are many more, and soon I'll introduce you to the most important of these, and believe me, you'll want to know them. Just as a teaser, 94% of humans are born with antibodies to the lectin in peanuts. How exactly do lectins help plants defend themselves? Well, lectins in the seeds, grains, skins, rinds, and leaves of most plants bind to carbohydrates, sugars, and particularly to complex sugars called polysaccharides, in the predator's body after it consumes the plant. Like smart bombs, lectins target and attach themselves to sugar molecules, primarily on the surface of the cells of other organisms, particularly fungi, insects, and other animals. They also bind to sialic acid, a sugar molecule found in the gut, in the brain, between nerve endings, in joints, and in all bodily fluids, including the blood vessel lining of all creatures. Lectins are sometimes referred to as sticky proteins because of this binding process, which means they can interrupt messaging between cells or otherwise cause toxic or inflammatory reactions, as we'll discuss later. For example, when lectins bind to sialic acid, one nerve is unable to communicate its information to another nerve. If you have ever experienced brain fog, think lectins. Lectins also facilitate the attachment and binding of viruses and bacteria to their intended targets. Believe it or not, some people, those who are more sensitive to lectins, are therefore more subject to viruses and bacterial infection than others. Think about that if you seem to get sick more often than your friends do. In addition to the potential to cause health problems, lectins also stimulate weight gain. The reason that wheat became the grain of choice in northern climates is thanks to a uniquely small lectin in wheat, known as wheat germ agglutinin, WGA, which is responsible for wheat's weight-gaining propensity. You heard that correctly. Wheat helped your ancestors gain or maintain weight in ancient times when food was often scarce. Back then, a wheat belly was a great thing to possess. And guess what? That WGA in the ancient forms of wheat is just as present in modern wheat, hence the weight gain. We will explore these implications further in the following chapters. A plant will do just about anything to keep your mouth off its seeds and save its babies, including sacrificing its leaves. By design, lectins either kill any animal that dares to eat it outright, or at the very least make that animal feel unwell. After all, a weakened enemy is more vulnerable. Assuming they survive their initial encounter with such a plant, Insects and other animals quickly learn not to eat any plant or its seeds that makes them feel bad or fail to thrive. The animal decides that that plant is not worth eating and moves on to greener fields and other species, while the plant and its babies survive. Again, it's a win-win situation, and the détente prevails. Ancient humans developed a host of ways to deal with lectins. Unfortunately, modern humans aren't so savvy. Instead, if we eat something that doesn't agree with us or makes us sick, we find or invent something. Think Nexium, a stomach acid reducer, or a drug such as ibuprofen that lessens pain, so we can continue to eat a substance designed to destroy, cause pain in, or at least weaken us. Speaking of stomach acid, get this. Not only do we keep eating foods that are designed to hurt us, but we also feed them to animals in the food chain, which suffer similarly from their diet. Left to their own devices, cows would never consume corn and soybeans. Their natural diet is grasses and other forage, but that is exactly what they are fed on industrial farms. The lectins in corn and soy are far more effective than grass in making the cow heavier and giving them a better ratio of fat. That same corn and grain in processed foods bulk you up as well, as you will learn in Chapter 5. Both soy and corn are laden with lectins foreign to cows, causing them to develop such severe heartburn and pain in swallowing that they actually stop eating. Yes, cows develop heartburn from these lectins, just as you do. To keep their beasts eating more of this fattening food, farmers dose them with calcium carbonate, the active ingredient in Tums. In fact, half the world's production of this compound is added to cattle feed to stop the heartburn, ensuring that cows continue to eat their unnatural diet of corn and soybeans. You really are what you eat. The lectins in beans and other legumes, wheat and other grains, and certain other plants are especially problematic for humans. First, not enough time has elapsed to allow our species to develop immunological tolerance to these substances, nor has sufficient time elapsed for the human gut microbiome to become fully capable of breaking down these proteins. Numerous health problems are the result, with gastric distress as just the tip of the iceberg. If you are impatient to know the range of the resultant potential health problems, open the enhancement and prepare to be shocked. Such plants are not the only place in which you'll encounter lectins. They also turn up in animal products. When cows and other animals eat grain or soy-based feed, both of which are full of lectins, these proteins wind up in the animal's milk or meat. The same thing happens with the meat and eggs of chickens raised on feed full of lectins. Ditto for farm-raised seafood, which dine on soy and corn as well. Until I saw firsthand in many of my canaries how removing such foods from their diet was the final key to restored health, I would not have believed this. In the mid-1980s, a personal experience effectively drove this point home. I had moved my wife and two young daughters to London, where I was a heart surgery fellow at Great Ormond Street, the renowned children's hospital. At that time, chickens in England were fed primarily ground-up fish meal. My girls missed their favorite American food of fried chicken, so as a special treat, I took them to the only KFC in town for dinner. No sooner had they bitten into a piece of chicken than they turned up their noses, claiming it was fish, not chicken. I tried to persuade them that it was indeed chicken, but in a way, they were right. Because it had been fed fish, the chicken was actually a fish. At that time, I didn't give any thought to the fact that a chicken fed corn or soybeans isn't actually a chicken, but instead a clucking, walking grain or bean. As the old saying goes, you are what you eat, but you are also what the thing you ate. When you consume organically raised produce and pastured animal products, and I do not mean free range, the nutrients in the plants and the nutrients the plants got from the soil, as well as the plants the animals ate, pass into your body and are incorporated into every one of your cells. Knowing how the food you eat was grown and raised is not just a lifestyle choice. It also directly affects your health. There is now conclusive evidence that organically grown vegetables and fruits do contain more vitamins and minerals than conventionally grown produce. But more important, they contain more polyphenols. Without getting too technical, these beneficial plant chemicals are found in tea, coffee, fruits and berries, and some vegetables. The same applies to eating pastured animal foods. But the implications of being what you eat, or the thing you ate, don't stop there. The lectins in the grain and soy fed to conventionally raised animals end up in the flesh, milk, or eggs of these animals, and ultimately in your gut, where they can still work their damage. Even organic and so-called free-range animals contain these lectins because they too are fed soy and corn, albeit organic versions. And by the way, it is perfectly legal to keep an animal inside a warehouse its entire life and call it free-range, as long as a door to the outside is open for a mere 5 minutes a day. Never mind that it is unlikely that any single bird packed cheek by jowl with thousands of other chickens ever manages to work its way to this door. There is a vast difference in a burger or milk or cheese made from a cow that grazed on grass in the summer and ate hay in the winter, and a burger made from an animal raised in a stockyard on lectin-rich corn and soy. To start, there's the difference in the ratio of omega-3 to omega-6 fats. With certain exceptions, omega-6 fats are inflammatory and omega-3 fats are anti-inflammatory. Corn and soy contain primarily omega-6 fats, while grass is high in omega-3 fats. But there's more to it than that. Remarkably, those same soybeans and grains make cows much fatter than do the equivalent number of calories in grass. This means that the source of calories plays an important role in how you metabolize them. Keep that in mind when we discuss weight gain. And compounding the issue, of course, is that in the United States, almost all soy and corn is also produced from genetically modified seed. We'll delve further into the effects of consuming GMO foods in Chapter 4. Success story. Life after chicken. Yvonne Kay, a 50-year-old Los Angeles woman, had severe lupus with joint pain, fatigue, and rashes, despite taking immunosuppressing drugs and practicing meditation. After a friend suggested she see me, I put her on the Plant Paradox program. Within a month, the joint pain, fatigue, and most of the rashes had resolved. She stopped her immunosuppressant medications and continued to do well. When I saw Yvonne about 4 months later, she was ecstatic about what had happened, except for some persistent eczema on her eyelids. She told me she was vigilant about avoiding all bad foods, and we went over the lists of good foods and bad foods with a fine-tooth comb. When we got to the good food list, I asked if she was eating any chicken. She replied that she ate only organic free-range chicken. And that's when we figured it out. She was effectively eating what the chickens had eaten, namely corn and soybeans. She was an indirect grain and legume eater. We immediately removed chicken from her diet. And sure enough, within 2 weeks, Yvonne's eczema had vanished. 3 years later, it is still gone. And so is the free-range chicken. The balance of power. So, where do humans stand in the war between the plant and animal worlds? Are we just pushovers for the damage that plant lectins and other chemicals can inflict on our poor bodies? Not at all. It's important to understand that although lectins can be toxic or inflammatory and have the ability to mess with your body's internal messaging system, all animals, including humans, have developed their own defensive systems to render lectins harmless, or at least mitigate their effects. A four-pronged defense mechanism protects us from the toxic effect of plants, and specifically of lectins. The first line of defense is the mucus in your nose and saliva in your mouth, collectively called mucopolysaccharides, meaning many sugars. Guess what those sugars are there for? To trap lectins. Remember, lectins like to bind to sugars. The next time your nose runs after eating spicy foods, you'll know that you've just eaten some lectins. That extra dose of mucus not only traps the lectins you just ate, but also adds an additional coating to your esophagus as your meal works its way down. The second line of defense is stomach acid, which in many cases does the job of digesting certain lectin proteins, although not all of them. The third line of defense is the bacteria in your mouth and gut, part of your microbiome, which have evolved to efficiently consume lectins before they have the opportunity to interact with the wall of your gut. The longer you have been eating particular plant lectins, the longer you have been producing gut bacteria specifically designed to diffuse them. That's why if you eliminate all gluten from your diet, the gluten-eating bugs die off. Then when you do revert to eating gluten or eat something you don't realize contains gluten, you cannot digest them, causing discomfort. The fourth and final line of defense is a layer of mucus produced by certain cells throughout your intestines. Like the mucus in your nose, mouth, throat, and extending all the way to your anus, this layer of gut mucus acts as a barrier. It keeps the plant compounds you have eaten in the gut, where they belong, using the sugars in the mucus to trap and absorb lectins. If you're a Star Wars or Star Trek fan, think of this mucosal layer as an activated force shield. Taken altogether, it's an effective system. Nevertheless, the more troops in the form of lectins thrown at these defenses, the more the sugar molecules in the mucus layer are used up, and the more likely lectins are to get where they really want to go, the living cells that line your gut. This is where the rubber meets the road. Of course, you do have another powerful weapon to employ in your battle with lectins, your brain. Once you know that certain foods are problematic, you should avoid them, eat them rarely, or mitigate their effects with the sorts of preparation methods our forebears long knew about, which we'll discuss in good time. You'll also soon learn why the use of drugs that eliminate stomach acid and the adoption of a completely gluten-free diet are ill-advised except in that small portion of the population diagnosed with celiac disease. Once you understand more about your gut and the microbes that call it home, you can use your brain to better correct these missteps. So, there you have the human defense strategy, and I'll share with you the specifics of how to fortify your defenses in part two. But, like the setup for an NFL football game, let's now look at the lectin offensive lineup. Plants attack your formidable defense system with their own three-pronged approach, making you feel sick on several fronts. Lectin attack strategy number one, get through the gut wall. The first mission of lectins is to pry apart what are called tight junctions between the cells in the mucosal wall lining your intestine. Believe it or not, the lining of your intestine is only one cell thick, while its surface area is equivalent to the size of a tennis court. Imagine that a wall just a single cell thick is responsible for manning this huge border. Your intestinal cells absorb vitamins, minerals, fats, sugars, and simple proteins, but not large proteins, and lectins are relatively large proteins. If all is well with your gut health and its mucus layer, lectins should not be able to squeeze past the mucosal cells. But if you ever engaged in the old playground game of Red Rover, think of how the big kids tried to pry your arms apart to break through the line. That's exactly what happens when lectins attack your mucosal wall. If one or more of the four lines of defense detailed before are breached, lectins can pry apart the tight junctions in the intestinal wall by binding with receptors on certain cells to produce a chemical compound called zonulin. Zonulin opens up the spaces between the cells of the intestinal lining, which enables lectins to access the surrounding tissues, lymph nodes, and glands, or bloodstream, where they have no business being. Once there, they attack like any foreign protein, prompting your body's immune system to attack them. Think of when you get a splinter under your skin and how your body's response is to attack the splinter with white blood cells, creating swelling and redness. While you can't see that response to lectins gaining access to off-limit territory in your body, I assure you that invading lectins prompt your immune system to respond in a similar fashion. I routinely see this when I measure inflammatory cytokines, which act like air raid sirens to alert the immune system to an incoming threat. Lectin attack strategy number two. Confuse the immune system with molecular mimicry. There are many examples in the animal kingdom of creatures that mimic other species to their own advantage. Some moths mimic spiders to get their spider predators to leave them alone. The harmless scarlet kingsnake looks remarkably like the deadly coral snake, creating a powerful deterrent to predators. Likewise, plants may mimic birds or insects to keep from being eaten by them. One insect, the well-named walking stick, looks just like a dried twig, helping protect it from predators. Therefore, we shouldn't be surprised to discover that plants purposely make lectins that are virtually indistinguishable from other proteins in your body, a tactic called molecular mimicry. Lectins are nearly indistinguishable from certain other proteins in your body. By mimicking such proteins, lectins fool the host's immune system, causing it to attack the body's own proteins. Or the lectins bind to cell receptors, acting like a hormone or blocking a hormone, thus disrupting communications within the body and wreaking havoc, which you'll learn about soon. I'm sure that on more than one occasion, you have had a passerby hail you down, using someone else's name, only to apologize when he or she realizes it is a case of mistaken identity. Molecular mimicry is similarly a case of inappropriate pattern matching. Our immune system cells and other cells use barcode scanners called TLRs, toll-like receptors, to identify proteins as friend or foe. These pattern receptors, built over hundreds of millions of years, have been subjected to new patterns in certain foods that unfortunately mimic a whole different set of compounds that instruct cells, particularly immune and fat cells, what to do. For instance, these compounds instruct fat cells to store fat when they shouldn't be storing fat, or they tell our white blood cells to attack our own bodies in the case of mistakes.